Hello and welcome to Inside Education, a weekly podcast for educators who are interested in teaching with me, Sean Delaney. I'm a primary teacher and teacher educator myself, and I have written a book about teaching called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. You can download close to 400 previous episodes of Inside Education by going to my website, seandelaney.com, and clicking on podcasts. You can get in touch with me by writing to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. You can follow me on Twitter using the handle @insideed. This week on the podcast, I'm delighted to bring you my interview with Dr. Karen Edge, who is a reader at the University College London Institute of Education and who has vast experience and expertise in the area of teacher motivation and school leadership. Karen Edge is currently working on a book about the cultural aspects of leadership in education. She was a keynote speaker at the recent annual conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network, the IPPN. You'll enjoy this podcast if you believe that a balance between work and life is worth striving for. It's also ideal for anyone already in school leadership or who aspires to be a leader in education, especially among those in Generation X, whose needs differ to those of their predecessors, the baby boomers. You'll also get insights on this week's podcast into how leadership in education differs across countries and across continents. When I met up with Karen Edge, I first asked her what her main message for Irish principals was when she addressed them in her keynote talk.
I think one of the reasons why I was invited was because I've been doing some work with IPPN and stakeholders around the country about what would make leadership careers sustainable. So I think most countries at the moment are struggling to find a way to make leading not only a joyous job, but one that's quite purposeful. And as new generations are entering the principalship, they want to work in different ways. So one of the things we were talking about yesterday was the work I'm doing across the system in terms of trying to find ways to help principals be able to stay in their job and make it meaningful.
So when you say principals want to be purposeful, what kind of things give principals purpose?
I think at the moment, what we're finding is a lot of the constraints that principals are working with. So in terms of student needs, managing multiple teachers in Ireland, working and teaching, working as a leader and teaching simultaneously, are creating some job-specific tensions, like that's what a principal is there for, to manage all those things. But within the context of accountability and what they're responsible for, sometimes we get the message often, not necessarily just in Ireland, that the reason why principals became principals are to lead teaching and learning and to work with teachers and students. And a lot of the requirements that government has, and rightly so, to be accountable, to share information, to collect data, to manage external relationships, are pulling them away from what that core purpose was.
Is it not imperative for principals that they do have to fulfill all this form filling and things like that? Like how do they actually create the time to have purpose in their work?
Well, I think that's so. I think purpose and paper pushing are probably things that most principal would tell you are not really of the same ilk. So I think for us, one of the things that my team does as we work around the world, we're looking at how principals are almost executing their work lives and their home lives. So we're deeply interested in how do you as a principal be a real person with a life outside of work and a real leader inside. So I think that's where the tension is. We spend a lot of time talking about time management and a lot of time talking about, you know, saying no to things, which governments are often not happy about. But I think what's most important is that sometimes when it's easy to do paperwork, and that's something that you get in trouble for not doing, that can take up so much of your time and the things that you really love doing fall by the wayside. So with the other conditions that are going on in work and pay and other challenges, that's one of the things that makes it most difficult to keep principals in the system, because they see that what they've joined up to do is not necessarily what they spend most of their time doing.
But the problem there is, isn't it, that if principals, say, neglect to fill out for certain forms, they might miss out on grants, or they might miss out on other opportunities for their schools, and it could be quite expensive for their schools.
So what I think is happening is that people are doing all the paperwork because you get in trouble for the paperwork. It's kind of like at home. You will know if you live with other people what you will get in trouble for not doing, whether it's putting your socks away or shutting the dishwasher or closing the cupboards. The things that you know someone will come down quite hard on you for not doing, you do because you don't want to cause trouble. And then the things that you really love doing, which might be spending time talking to your partner or spouse or doing other things, sometimes fall by the wayside because you're too busy trying to make sure that you haven't done the things, that you've done the things that you'll get in trouble with. So I think it's quite rare for principals not to keep up with their administrative work. But when a principal is doing their administrative work, what are the things that they're not doing? So it's not to say that the principals we work with are not saying that they don't want to do administrative work and that they don't want to do work that provides account for what's going on in their school. I think what they are asking for often is sort of sensible accountability, that not things that are not being repeated by different parts of the department, things that they feel are purposeful and aligned with what the Irish education system wants for their children, which is, you know, great teaching and learning and an experience and an opportunity for them to learn and grow.
You've been working on a project with principal teachers under the age of 40, Generation X. Can you tell us about that project?
A lot of that was born out of my work. So I'm Canadian by accent, which you can hear. I'm also Canadian and British by citizenship. And I had done quite a lot of work for the British government in New York. And I observed in New York and in Toronto, where I had done my work in grad school, and in London, where I work at UCL at the Institute of Education, that there was really a new generation of principals and vice principals stepping into the role. And what we know about corporate theory and psychology and business is that different generations behave different ways. So millennials behave in a different way about work. They're much less concerned about localized networks. So they like working with people that they like, but a lot of their social connections are online. They don't necessarily need a lot of money because they're quite young in their life at the moment, but what they really like is titles. And they're also very ambitious. So we know about Gen Xers that a lot of them are hitting the stage of their life where they have children or they're caring for parents, or they had grown up where one of their parents was not in the home. Gen Xers are the first generation where often the mums would go out and work. So a lot of Gen Xers are fiercely independent. They like a lot of autonomy. They are the generation that started wanting really flexible workplaces. And then boomers are the ones who are just sort of starting to retire at the moment, who grew up in an era where, you know, being serious and being able to put work ahead of everything else, being really, really obsessed about quality, being obsessed about titles and pay, that has created a whole different landscape of principal working. So what I had seen was a lot of the school systems that we work with in schools were designed by boomers who worked in a particular way for a particular generation of students. And now that we have Gen Xers, and a lot of Gen Xers are wanting to work differently, the school system and the structure of working is actually not aligning with their desire to have greater work-life balance. So based on what I saw, there was a lot more pressure on leaders in London, which is a system that's radically decentralized. So when you become a leader of a school, you are responsible for absolutely everything, with very little support from a district or a local authority. In New York, there were different versions of local authorities that you could buy into, and there was quite a lot of turnover of young leaders. And then in Ontario, we kind of ran into a situation where there were lots of younger leaders, but they weren't able to get promoted because the conditions of work in Ontario at the time were so good that people weren't retiring early. So it appeared to me that different cities were struggling with different kinds of sort of factors and conditions that were influencing people's choice to lead, and that may be something worth looking at.
So what do Generation X principals need?
So based on the business theory and the sociology theory, workers who are Gen X workers usually like to have a high degree of autonomy. They like to be recognized for their work. They will like titles more than money, although that changes if you work in a big city. They want to work sort of more globally. They're very technically literate. And what we saw in the Gen X leaders was that they're very keen to work collaboratively. So lots of people will say, well, yes, the business literature and the education literature says work collaboratively, which is why they've chosen to do it. But what we've observed is that that drive and ability to work collaboratively has more than likely come from how they went to school when they were younger. So the teachers of the people who are retiring from teaching today are really responsible for the leaders that we have in our system, which I remind them on a regular basis. And so we have a generation of leaders who are very comfortable working collaboratively. They're incredibly comfortable with diversity. They're incredibly comfortable shoulder tapping and ensuring that the leaders coming after them have a chance to move forward. But they also want to be able to manage their lives in a way that gives them a life outside of work. And in our traditional school system, in England, we're starting to get a lot better about job shares, about people being able to work half-time, flexible working. But the public sector is really slow to catch up with the corporate sector in terms of creating alternate ways of work. A teacher can't do flexible work without it being agreed. A teacher couldn't really work from home if they were supposed to be in the classroom. So we now have a generation of leaders who've been watching all of their colleagues work in these very interesting ways, who are working in a much more traditional way. And when the pressure that they're under is not in balance with the way that they want to work, that's where it sort of goes awry. And we think that if governments were able to pay a bit more attention to the generational differences of the leaders and teachers in schools, that they might actually be able to construct some better solutions for recruiting and retaining them.
If Generation X leaders are more collaborative, does that mean that they may be less decisive, perhaps, or maybe more reluctant to take decisions on their own without kind of conferring or consulting with their colleagues or their peers?
So I think what is known about sort of collegiality and collaborative decision making is that, and you'll know this from your work as well, that if somebody involves you in a decision, you're much more likely to believe that that decision is a good one. It's just basic human nature. So I think what the Gen X leaders that we work with who try and work very collaboratively, it's interesting. So they will want to bring people to the table to have a conversation about the decision. And we've heard sort of time and time again that when they first start their role, they're very, very collaborative because they think that's how they have to work. And they're building respect from their team. But as they get farther into their role, they say they get a bit more confident and they're willing to make hard decisions because they've got confidence that they're doing the right thing. But one of the things that we've seen is that there's some very clear lines in our research that point to some differences in gender, in race, and who's allowed to do what. So often, if a male leader, and this is also sort of evidenced in the wider literature, if a male leader is collaborative, it's because they want to seek out individuals who can help inform the decisions and they'll make the final decision. But often if a woman leader, especially a young woman leader, is trying to create collaborative conditions, it's because she doesn't know enough and she needs other people to help her make that decision.
That's how it's perceived.
Often that's how it's perceived. So it would be, it's very interesting that the leaders that we're working with, because in terms of diversity, they're dealing with age as their fundamental limit, and often they're much, in the psychology literature and sociology literature, it's called age inappropriate for their roles. So it's kind of like Doogie Howser, which was an American telly show where you had a doctor who was 12. When you have somebody who doesn't fit the idea of what you think they should be, the amount of pressure that those leaders can be under is greater. So what my team is trying to do is understand, are there things that the newer generations of leaders are wanting or are experiencing, and are there things that education systems can do to recognize that and sort of mitigate some of those challenges that they face?
Because part of the challenge would seem to be knowing when it's appropriate to make a collaborative decision and when it's appropriate to make an autonomous decision.
And I don't think that, you know, we rarely work with leaders where we talk about their decision making and I worry about the foundations of what their choices are. So I think the training in Ireland, and one of the reasons why I will come to Ireland on a regular basis, is that I have a lot of faith in how the Irish education system is trying to care for the leaders that they work with. The Centre for School Leadership is doing some excellent training and development work, and they do it in consultation with IPPN and NAPD. And I think there's a real commitment in Ireland that is, if you come from outside, you can feel that there's trust and faith in the leaders that you have and in helping them do their job better. So I would say that around when to collaborate and when not to collaborate, most leaders are very much able to make that decision and make the right one for them at that time.
Your research brings you across countries and across continents. To what extent is leadership in education culturally specific, and to what extent is it the same everywhere?
So my experience as a Canadian working in the US and then working in England is that there's some very, very substantial differences in how the countries are organized, in how gender is treated, in how race and ethnicity is treated, and the greater social, even the degree of trust. So in Ontario, there's a reasonably high degree of trust and there's a very high degree of rule following because we haven't established a lot of markets. So there was, you know, for a long time, one phone company and there's one rail company. So you're not diversifying and there's less competition. So in those systems where there's a low degree of competition, there's a high degree of centralization where decisions are made centrally but in collaboration with others. We think that there's sort of a better foundation for what the relationships between individuals look like. So that's one thing in terms of how the country functions. So in England at the moment, you can imagine there's a very low degree of trust, which is pretty much the same all the time. It's worsened by Brexit. And that means that there is often a lack of faith and belief and trust from parents in the education system, which creates challenges for leaders, in teachers who have to move around to find different jobs. So in our study, we saw that there really was a substantial difference, even down to what the life of being an adult in a country is. So in New York, if you get pregnant, or you have a child. When we were doing the research, adoption leave wasn't possible. Surrogacy leave wasn't possible. Maternity leave was only possible. And you got 6 weeks unpaid leave under the category of illness leave, whereas being a principal in Ontario meant you would get a year leave, most of which was paid at between 90 and 95%. Whereas in England, you get 4 months paid at full pay, depending on how long you've been at your employer, and then a period of time after that that's paid at a reduced rate from the government. So the cost of living has an effect on what being a principal looks like, how close you are to your parents and your family in terms of childcare and other things. The inspection system will change, the relationships that you have within the school, whether you can fire your teachers. So what we've found very much so is that you can look at culture and leadership through three lenses. One is, what is it like to be an adult in that country? And what is your day-to-day experience? Do people say hi to you? So in Ireland, I like being here because everyone says hello. Whereas in London, no one will ever say hello to you. Even if you're in the same neighborhood and you've known them before, they won't talk to you. And we talked about collaboration before. And I think for me, there's sort of a pump priming of how you behave. So if you've walked to work in Dublin and people have said hi, or you've driven and people have said hi, by the time you get to work, you have that sort of social bug. You're already prepped for your day in collaboration in schools. Whereas if you're in a country or a city where no one really talks to each other, then you're not really ready to collaborate, and you're doing it with a real distrust possibly of what's happening. So we think that there's not enough attention in the research literature to what being an adult in the system looks like. So do you have good health care? You know, we did our research and asked questions about, you know, why do you stay in your job? And one of the things that we learned in New York was a lot of principals were saying, I'm going to stay because I get free health care. And it's not free health care, it's part of their package. But if they weren't working in a public sector job, their family would not have health coverage. Whereas in Ontario and London, we have, you know, very similar versions of the National Health Service where you get healthcare for free. So we often will borrow ideas and policies from countries, from one country to another, that doesn't really account for what it's really properly like to be from that country. And we expect that if you adopt a few things from Finland, they're going to work really well in Ireland. But if it turns out the infrastructure in Ireland to take care of the grown-ups isn't the same, you may actually struggle to make that work.
And what are the rewards of being principal today?
I think it depends on who you talk to and what day you talk to them. So a lot of the time, it depends on the time of year as well. We don't have statistics, but my guess is if you talk to them at the beginning of the year, there's a little bit of hesitation having come back from holiday, and then a lot of anticipation and enthusiasm for getting started and achieving it. If you're just passed an inspection and it's gone well, you're probably quite happy and relieved. And if it hasn't gone terribly well, you're probably quite worried and saddened. So I think the rewards of being a leader are still going to be the ones that we've had in the past, working with children, understanding how they work. A lot of principals will say that's what they miss the most when they're not a teaching principal. But a lot of teaching principals in Ireland will say that it's really difficult for them to be able to teach and manage the administrative load at the same time, which then means we're actually halving or quartering their rewards and then wondering why they're not staying in the job. So I think one of the things that I'm excited about in terms of working with colleagues in Ireland is really trying to figure out, what do we know about leaders in Ireland? What do we know about why they stay and where they move and what they do? And then what is it that different agencies across the country can do to try and make that job as rewarding and purposeful as possible so that people will want to do it and then they'll stay in the job when they're there?
How can school leaders achieve work-life balance?
So this was kind of what we were talking about yesterday, and I think I have some pretty specific advice. One of the things that I'll say to leaders is, no one will ever tell you to work less. No one will ever really say to you, I'd like you to work less. So one of the things that we say to leaders is, unless you make some choices for yourself about managing your time differently, it'll be very, very difficult for you to wait till the day that someone tells you to work less before you make some substantial changes. So one of the things that we'll say to leaders that we work with is, you need to really look at what you're responsible for day to day and week to week, and think really clearly about, are there things that I'm doing because I love them but I don't have to do them? Or are there things that I don't really enjoy doing and I'm doing them because I feel I have to do them? And what is the minimum threshold that you can get away with in terms of completing the tasks that you're responsible for and caring for the adults and kids in your care? And a lot of the time, leaders are very, very committed to this notion of being busy, because everyone will answer the question of, you know, how are you with I'm busy? So we've developed this environment, both in business and in public sector work, where being busy is seen as sort of a badge of honor. And I think our team is really trying quite hard to say, it's not a badge of honor. And it's not a badge of honor if you're ignoring your family, if you're not golfing on the weekend, which is something you love, if you're not going out and doing things that make you happy. We're trying to help people sort of return to that position where, you know, you need a life outside to be the best leader you can be inside.
The other thing you've done some thinking about is the idea of schools partnering with each other. Why is that important?
So the work that we did when I first came to London was very much around schools in the UK, that in Ireland was one of our countries, and the British Isles, however you'd like to define it, which will probably change in the next few weeks. We were looking at how schools in Scotland, Ireland, and England were actually, and Wales, were working in collaboration with other international schools. And it was a really interesting project. So British Council, originally it was DFID, came to me, and British Council then came and planned. We worked with four or five partners, and they said, does being in a partnership with a school in Africa and Asia benefit students in Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and England? And my response was quite cheeky at the time, given that I was quite a young academic. I said, if you can give me a school in Scotland and a school in Sri Lanka and no parents, only kids, I control the curriculum and we control the curriculum in Sri Lanka, and then I am the one who's responsible for all of their global learning, then I will be able to tell you that. But my guess is it's above your budget. So what I think we should do instead is develop a set of proxies about what are the things that would tell us a bit about if there's more intercultural learning going on in the school, and then we'll research that. So I think there's quite a lot of theory that underpins the notion of the sort of the contact hypothesis, that you will be more engaged with people from other cultures and other countries if you've actually spent time and learned about them. So those programs are designed to broaden the horizons of kids and teachers in England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland by giving them access to partners and funding to fund partnerships in those schools. So I would never say that those programs make a difference to the learning of students in school, because it's really hard to measure. However, I would say that we found that there are certain factors that make partnerships work, and they're the same that, you know, probably not surprisingly, the same that make partnerships within a country work. So there's a degree of mutual respect and trust. There's something that each person can learn from the other, but it doesn't have to be the same. There are a set of agreed sort of goals that people will try to achieve together, and then a sense of points where you can stop and look back and evaluate the kind of work that you've been doing. So we think that, you know, I'm a fan of partnership. I'm in Ireland because I'm working in partnership with different parts of the government and with IPPN. But partnership takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes an ability to say, it's not working for me, how can we make it work? And I disagree with you, how could we make it better? And I think that's where, you know, some of the skills that the teachers were learning about just working with people from different places in itself is something that's very beneficial.
And how can teachers, and principal teachers in particular, establish meaningful relationships with schools in another country?
So I think there's lots of different ways that they do it. So there's usually funding in most of the big programs for a school visit. So I just had a chat with a head teacher here who's interested in learning more about resilience and is involved in an Erasmus program. And what he was saying was, you know, is there a place that we should go in Europe to learn more about resilience? So my pushback to him was, you need to know about what kind of, how you're defining resilience and what you want it to achieve for your school. And how can we then find you a partner in a country in another place where you can go and really learn specifically what you want to know? So I think, you know, it's the same, you know, people online date now. It's not something I know anything about, but I have, you know, friendships and sort of collegial relationships that I've developed with people that I've met once very briefly or have never really met in real life. And we have opportunities to talk via Zoom and Skype. And it's that dance of trying to find a place where you can find something that you're both mutually interested in, and having faith that that will happen if you have enough commitment to learning about someone and learning about what they do and finding a way to do something good together. It will come over time, but you're going to have to try in different ways. So in our research, there were schools that were writing letters, but the letters would go missing, and the schools in Africa and Asia sometimes didn't have computers. And so in some ways, there was a technical solution, providing equipment that would allow the schools to communicate real time in a way that many of us in developed countries are used to. So there's the technical side of communication and building a relationship. There's the learning side about, you know, what is life actually like there. And then there's really just finding a way to like each other. Because if you don't like someone that you're partnering with, it will be really, really difficult to get anything done.
We're coming near the end, Karen, so I just wanted to ask you a few questions that I ask all guests, general questions. So the first one is, what is school for, or what are schools for?
Oh, the age-old question. So this is what gets debated everywhere, and it changes over time. I think if you asked a politician, a conservative politician, what schools are for, they would tell you it was to create workers for the economy. If you asked someone at the other end of the spectrum, it would be about creating citizens who, or developing citizens that are able to engage in democracy and who understand notions of fairness and equality. You know, one of the really good ways for me to answer that is I have a 9-year-old who's quite an extraordinary young man, but when he was 3, he decided during one of the UK general elections, that he wanted to know what the parties meant. So as his mum, I'm trying to explain without bias what the, you know, in one sentence, what each of the parties are for. And it's been really interesting. So he very clearly declared himself a Labour voter, but watching him learn through school, you know, about being a fair global citizen, about being a good person, about learning content that will help him, but also learning skills that will help him, has been interesting. And I think as a parent now, in addition to being an academic, and I worked in politics and I worked in government, and I think schools are, you know, it's not a daycare. It's not to create workers in the sense that they need a specific set of skills. I think learning to learn and being able to solve problems is incredibly important. But I think now, in the world that we're working in, the socio-emotional learning, the what, you know, some people call the soft side or the soft hard side, I think those are skills that is what makes the difference in terms of being successful. And I think our schools play a really important role at bringing people together and having conversations that are difficult and learning about how to coexist and also aspire to be the best person and sort of contributor that you can be.
Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
I think there was lots. Probably there was, I was very fortunate to be able to write a chapter in a book, a very small chapter, for the Governor General of Canada, of Ontario, who represents the Queen in Ontario. And I was assigned the Sustainable Development Goal 4, and I was to write something personal about that. And I wrote about a teacher that I had, Mrs. Thompson, in grade 1 in Canada, and I just moved to the school. And I talked a little bit about what she taught me in terms of fairness. And one of the students that I went to school with was of Japanese heritage. And at the time, he'd been bitten by a dog. And the rabies treatment they were giving him wasn't working, and they had to rush something from somewhere else. And in the chapter, I wrote that our teacher had told us that it was because he was Japanese, and there was something about him being Japanese that meant that the how they were trying to manage the virus didn't work. And for me at the time, that was a really poignant lesson about learning that we may be all, we're all the same, but that we may need different things. And I think that moment sort of drove a lot of my work. And then I would say Mrs. McKinley, who realized that I was an absolute phonics dork, and I got to take my phonics book home, and I went through year 2 and year 3 phonics, probably in the space of a month, taught me that it doesn't really, and my parents just, I don't, at the time, if my son did it, I'd think he was bonkers, but I would bring my phonics book home, and that was all I would do. And I literally went through 2 years worth of phonics, probably in the space of a month, and giving me the freedom to be able to obviously be a crazy dork taught me a lot about the freedom that I need to let my PhD students have. And sort of you give them the space to run, and you trust that if somebody has an interest, you need to nurture that while making sure they have everything else to make it successful.
Who or what inspires you?
It's the same as questions about sort of resilience and about, you know, what makes your job fun. I think at different times, there's different people that inspire me in different ways. I've had a really difficult and interesting couple of years. I was injured for a long time and then went through a divorce, and it's there's a couple of people that I've come across and worked with in the last little while that have been really helpful at making me realize that work and life can be fun again. So I've been working with now a brilliant colleague whose name is Judy Goldberg, who owns a company that works globally called Wondershift. And she's an absolutely brilliant coach who sees the world with sort of a sense of joy and optimism that I had lost over, you know, quite a difficult period of time. One of the things that inspires me is watching my son and his friends. So they're 9 and they're boisterous and they're asking a lot of questions and bringing a lot of issues to the table that as an adult, I don't think I ever would have expected. So I find a lot of inspiration probably in trying to find ways to solve problems without messing up my kid. And probably finally, there's a lot of people sort of in the education world who are just doing really extraordinary work, and they're doing it on behalf of people who wouldn't necessarily get their voices at the table. So my son is a mad fan of an author in England whose name is Dan Friedman. He's written a book series called Jamie Johnson, which is on BBC. And he's been writing books that actually managed to capture the attention of a lot of people who never would have read. And he links them to sports, and he finds ways to work in a way that brings people together that wouldn't necessarily be united by a book and have conversations that are really rich. And watching sort of authors and not necessarily speakers, but education happens everywhere we are. And I think sometimes we forget that learning happens everywhere we are. And I think I've become sort of a collector of colleagues and ideas over the last couple of months, just watching people who are doing their job with so much passion and so much joy is really starting to, it's starting to rub off a bit, and I can sort of feel that excitement and enthusiasm and inspiration starting again.
In relation to the Wonder Shift, the woman, so is she working with you as your coach?
So it was interesting. So I'm a big believer in serendipity and sort of not necessarily that things happen for a reason, but you need to sort of be present where you are. And I was shopping for trousers with my now ex-husband, and there was an amazing, well, I didn't know she was amazing at the time, North Americans chat. I was Canadian, she was American. We were shopping in Covent Garden. We started a conversation, and it turned out that she had worked as a coach and been the director of leadership development for Disney Cruises, for all sorts of organizations, and was very firmly committed to gender and gender coaching and development. So I had kept her card. My life had headed in some different directions, and I'd always kept it sitting on my desk. And I ended up in my provost job realizing that it might just be really helpful to have someone as a sounding board myself. So I, you know, Google stalked her and found her and said to her, can I pay you to be my coach? And her response was, I only really coach executive groups. I don't really coach just single executives. And so we agreed that it would just be fun, and that it would, in addition to finding us a way to help improve my practice as a leader, it would also give us a chance to explore different areas of leadership and gender and sort of development that we wanted to. So what started as a very serendipitous conversation evolved into a coaching relationship, which then has, I actually literally just got off the phone with her. The reason why I was late was because I was meeting with Judy, and we're now starting to think about projects that we can do together that would be good for leaders both in education and beyond. So we're spending a little bit of time sort of bashing around ideas around accelerated leadership development for leaders that are at the top of their game. So often in education systems, we work with aspiring leaders and new leaders. And then once you've done it for a while, we often ignore you because what is there that we can teach you and how do you learn best? So I'm doing some of that work in England, and Judy and I may do it together. And we're also looking at co-leadership, executive co-leadership. So what happens when you have two, you know, CEOs or COOs? What if you had a co-secretary of state for education? Would it enable us if we started creating positions where people could share them, allow more people to take on those roles?
And what was it about Judy that made her such a good coach for you?
Well, part of it was I was ready. So, you know, it's hard when you're a leadership specialist to actually stop and say, I need a leadership coach. So I think that was one of the things about me personally being ready to be in a position where I was as vulnerable as you needed to be effective with a coach. I think what made her, shockingly, what I think made her really helpful was we're almost the same age, and we both grew up in North America at the same period of time. So we shared a set of cultural references and a set of probably a sort of continental optimism, which may sound odd, but sort of a way of working that was really helpful. So I think she has a set of tools that she uses with her clients around just sort of really simple prompts and questions that are very, very thought-provoking. And for me, taking that time to think about my practice and what I wanted in my future in a way that was really different was incredibly helpful.
And finally, Karen, have you a favorite book, writer, or blog about education?
I was really, really fortunate to take on a role at, I work at University College London, and I've recently served for the last 3 years as the Pro Vice Provost International. So my job was as the Assistant Vice President International, and it caused me to sort of turn my attention to things that weren't about schools anymore. So I've just come back from 6 months of sabbatical where I'm working on two books of my own. So I would actually say that at the moment, there's not, I don't have a favorite, but I'm also the kind of person who doesn't really have a, I've never really had a best friend. And I think it goes back to probably to Mrs. Thompson in grade one, where I realized that, you know, learning from lots of people at different times is probably the best way to go. So there are some people, I mean, Viv Grant, have you had a chance to talk to her? She was extraordinary this morning, and our paths have sort of crossed at a distance, but her talk was incredibly powerful. And, you know, I tweeted her and said, I have a new geek crush, because I think she'll definitely be someone that I'm following.
And Karen Edge is following Viv Grant in more ways than one, because my guest on last week's podcast was Viv Grant. Many thanks to Karen Edge from the University College London Institute of Education for taking the time to record this interview. I spoke to Karen at the annual conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network. Remember, you can download this podcast and almost 400 other podcasts by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. You can email me to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. You can follow me on Twitter, where I am @InsideEd. I'd be delighted if you could leave a review and a rating for the programme on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, can be ordered from your local library or from online bookstores. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Have a great week.